Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this very first day of December. This hour of the program, How to Get America Back to Work. A job summit will take place at the White House on Thursday of this week. The president announced the forum last month, right after the nation's unemployment rate topped 10%. He said he wants to hear ideas about how the government might further spur businesses to hire, building on last winter's $787 billion stimulus package. He has invited a number of people to the White House, 130 business leaders, union chiefs, academics, mayors, and representatives of nonprofit groups. We have two guests with us the first hour of our program today. James Carr is joining us the first half hour. James is chief operating officer for the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, which is a national association of 600 local development organizations. They're dedicated to improving the flow of capital to communities and promoting economic mobility. He's also a visiting professor at Columbia University and a member of the Insight Experts of Color Network. He has also worked as Assistant Director for Tax Policy with the U.S. Senate Budget Committee and as Research Associate at the Center for Urban Policy Research at Rutgers University. He has consulted on financial modernization and housing finance to China, Mexico, Turkey, and Colombia, has served on congressional delegations to South Africa and Ghana on housing and economic development, and has published and lectured extensively on housing and urban policy. He wrote an interesting piece on what it is we need to build jobs in this country. He'll talk about job training, increased access to existing jobs for hard-hit communities and rebuilding the middle class. And we'll be welcoming phone calls. I'm particularly interested in hearing from those of you who may have lost your job or feel as though you're underemployed, what you're doing to get by and how you're finding the job search. Is it difficult to find something these days? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. James Carr, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Are you alarmed by this rate? It's over 10% in some parts of the country. Does that seem really high to you, James?
Kathleen, that is an extraordinary number. And the unfortunate thing is that it is continuing to grow. And even more so, when you peel back that onion and look at that number, there are many, many disturbing aspects of it. So, for example, that number doesn't capture a lot of people who are nevertheless working only part-time or who have just simply given up out of frustration because there is only one job for every six people looking now. So if you looked at what would be considered an effective unemployment rate, those people who are out of work who would really like to get back into the market full-time, that rate is now approaching 18%.
Ooh.
Another way to look at that unemployment number is if you look by types of households. So if you're looking at African Americans, for example, the unemployment rate already exceeds 15%, and for Latinos, 13%. And then again, you can cut this number another way if you look at young workers just entering the labor market. Again, much higher than is found for the general unemployment number. So it's really important not just to look at the general 10.2, but in communities across the country or across the state right there, look to see those communities that tend to have disproportionate numbers of people of color or tend to have disproportionately younger workers, they're suffering even more so.
Right. How discouraging is that? One job for every six people looking for work.
Absolutely. It's discouraging. And you're beginning to see statistics that are showing some other characteristics of this number. Just to stick with that number, over a third of people now who are unemployed are considered long-term unemployed, which means that that market is just not growing. Things are getting worse. For people who are experiencing long-term unemployment, that predisposes them to a number of things. So, for example, poverty. Once their benefits finally run out, they're going to go to poverty unless they have substantial amounts of savings to rescue them. And we've seen last year the poverty numbers grew by more than 2.5 million. It was frightening. And yet the reality of it is that unemployment is even worse this year, so that number is likely to go up. People accessing things like food stamps are now at record highs. So we're in a very difficult position, and I think the most fundamental thing to remember is that this market is not correcting itself. It hasn't been correcting itself since 07. It's just that the interventions really haven't been aimed at the core problems that the economy has faced.
The interventions have been placed where?
So most of the substantial amount of intervention so far has been bailing out the banks.
Right.
And it has been problematic from the very beginning, because the problem that the banks had was that they had shopped and peddled. It was really the mortgage market where this crisis occurred, and it was mortgage products that were not intended or designed to be sustainable, but rather those loans had to be modified every 2 to 3 years, refinanced, every 2 to 3 years to keep them affordable. And when house prices took a nosedive in 2007, that whole house of cards fell apart. Now, some people blame the homeowners. They say, well, those homeowners took out loans they shouldn't have, they couldn't afford. Fine. But for every loan, there was a lender. So if you're, with those two parties, if you know the problem that the banks are facing is that the consumers are losing their homes, one would think that you would help the consumers, because that would help the consumers and the banks and communities, etc. Instead, what we had was a federal policy that almost exclusively pumped money into the banks, and it hasn't worked because the consumers have continued to lose their homes, and we tried to make up the losses by giving money to the banks. And so now we're 2.5 years into this crisis, and guess what? The largest banks that receive most of the federal subsidies are now showing a profit. But the rest of the banking industry is on its knees. So, for example, the FDIC, which insures the banks, the consumers against bank losses, that the fund is now depleted. It's depleted. We're en route to the worst year of bank insolvencies in history, and we still have over 500 banks now on what's called the problem or watch list that could potentially fail. And so the bailout hasn't worked, and the reason it hasn't worked is consumers have continued to go to foreclosure. As they're going to foreclosure, they're finding it difficult to pay other bills, such as credit cards. As the economy has softened, commercial loans are now failing, loans for things like shopping centers, multifamily housing projects, et cetera, et cetera. So the economy is being pulled downward, now largely driven by unemployment.
Right. We need, you say, job training. We need jobs that will translate into training that will translate into real jobs or into careers. We've talked about this before. Has there been a time in American history where a robust job training program has really succeeded? And how would we organize such a thing? The third part of the question is, do you sense there's any enthusiasm for such a massive effort?
Well, let me just back up and say that in my view, the nature of this whole crisis in jobs is that we need a multi-pronged strategy. So it's not just a matter of training people for jobs. It's a matter of immediately getting people back to work who don't need training, who are already trained, who are prepared for jobs, and who could potentially work tomorrow. And so, for example, there are state and local governments all across the country, including right there, that can't pay their bills, because tax revenues have gone down, and they're laying off municipal employees.
Right.
So one of the part of another round of stimulus would be keep those people in their jobs, or allow state and local governments to reemploy people to do public service, important public service needs right now. There are actually school districts around the country that are laying off school teachers. The last thing we need to do is lay off school teachers and damage the educational futures of our children. We have roads that need to be repaired. We need bridges that need to be repaired. A lot of those projects really should be funded now. With respect to training, yes, the Department of Labor has a whole laundry list of programs and a large number of both community institutions and labor unions and others who have a very broad variety of training programs that could lead directly to jobs. the point that I was making in my piece, Kathleen, is that we don't need job training that happens in a classroom, whereby people just get training and then that's it. At the end of it, it's gone. They need job training that's an apprenticeship that's connected to, for example, the construction industry, whereby once they're enrolled in that program, they know that they will have a job in that construction industry at the time the training is over, and that much of the training is actually on-the-job training in a whole variety of industries.
The stimulus money, and there was a lot of that money, were there any jobs that did immediately put people back to work, or did we just fall short of the mark on that completely?
Well, on the stimulus program, the amount of money that actually went to creating, first of all, probably the majority of that, the jobs creation portion of that stimulus package is still in the pipeline waiting to get spent. But probably only a couple of $100 billion of the full package actually went to the real core infrastructure program spending that you heard a lot of talk about. Unfortunately, that package had a lot of things in there that did not in any way relate to creating a job, such as across-the-board tax cuts and things of that nature. You know, if you're a middle-class household who's worrying about paying your bills and you get a $600 rebate, the last thing you're going to go out and is spend. You're going to put that in your bank account, and that didn't create a job. And so a next round of stimulus spending really should focus on that infrastructure piece, the jobs of the future. There was a lot of discussion about green jobs of the future. We need to come back to those conversations. And also, we should not be shy about the federal government employing people. During the Great Depression, those public works jobs provided an important safety net for people, as well as helping to build skills and create lots of extraordinary projects, dams, highways, right, bridges across America. So we need to look at those kinds of programs again.
Obviously, it's a difficult time to do that, James, and people are going to wonder. The president is probably going to announce a significant increase in the number of troops going to Afghanistan. It's an enormously expensive proposition. We have health care on the table here in the United States, an expensive proposition. How do we do this? Obviously, it's necessary, and it seems to me as though it ought to be a priority, but how are we going to do it financially?
Well, you know, it's an excellent question. Right now, there's this big debate in Washington. Should we worry about the deficit or should we worry about putting people back to work? The fastest way to eliminate the deficit is to put people back to work. Because once the economy is working, the fastest way to lower that deficit is to increase tax revenue as a result of people actually going to work and buying things and having an earned income. And so if we say, well, the deficit is too high, we're sort of caught in this, you know, in this quicksand, because without creating new jobs, the job situation is just simply going to get worse, which will create even greater deficit, which will create even greater job problems. So as I see it, and I know I'm not alone, many people see you just don't have a choice. We have to push our way out of this crisis. It's not an easy thing to do. The choices are not simple, but the fact of the matter is the best way to eliminate the deficit is to put America back to work. And right now, we're not putting America back to work. The job losses are increasing.
Mm. Phone calls for you, James, in just one moment. James Carr is our guest this half hour, Chief Operating Officer for the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, a national association of 600 local development organizations. They want to improve the flow of capital to communities and promote economic mobility. He's worked really all over the world on these issues. We're welcoming calls for him at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. He wrote an interesting piece for New Deal, a project of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. They asked a number of historians, economists, and other public thinkers to reflect on the lessons of the New Deal and to explore new and big ideas for how to get America back to work. To your phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The president is giving his address on Afghanistan this evening at West Point. We will be carrying that address from 7 to 8 o'clock tonight here on the Ideas Network in lieu of the second hour of On Point. So you can listen here. Second hour of our program today, someone suggested, and I think it's a good one, that we title the hour Polar Bears Against Climate Change. We'll be speaking with the author of On Thin Ice, The Changing World of the Polar Bear. Richard Ellis is joining us. His book has that title. All right, let's go to phone calls. Joanne is our first caller from West Allis. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, thank you, Kathleen. Long story short, my situation is I'm a registered nurse, and I had planned to work until I'm about 70 or so. I had been in good health, but had to have a couple of joint replacements and was off work too long, and so I lost my job that way.
Oh.
And hearing about the healthcare is the field to get into, and I can't find a job, and then on unemployment where you have to contact two people every week, and I'm back to calling the same people again, and nobody's hiring except medical assistants, and so I don't know if this is the program to call into, or I'm in my early 60s and in good health now, but it was like a perfect storm for me. I was off work, so I had to use up my IRA, and then the stock market crashed. And
oh, dear.
Now I can't find a job. And so, you know, I'm in the situation where I would give anything to work, and I don't know what to do.
And this is one of the fields, isn't it, James, where we had thought, at least I thought, that people were hiring.
Exactly. So the caller's it's a little bit off of center, because healthcare has been one of those areas that has done quite well. And in fact, women in healthcare have done quite well, relatively speaking. Remember, I said you can pull that that onion back. You'll find that a disproportionate share of the unemployed in this recession are men who are in a lot of the construction fields and other heavy labor. But having said that, I think the caller represents, in some ways, one of those case studies of what I said, we could put people back to work now. Here is a person who is highly skilled, who's ready to work, and there certainly is no shortage of people who need quality health care. And so that's why I'm saying one of the things that, would be helpful is to stop fixating on the federal deficit and focus on the fact that the faster we put people back to work, the more we will generate income and jobs and helpfully stimulate. That's why they're calling it a stimulus, stimulate the economy back into productive mode.
Thank you very much, Joanne, for your call. I hope you find something soon. Rick from Prentice, hi.
Oh, hello. In lieu of the fact that all politics is local, Congressman Dave Obey, who's the chairman of that big committee in Congress that spends all the people's money, when he was up in northern Wisconsin at one of his political gatherings, that was 9 or 10 months before the stock market crashed and the economy collapsed. And I warned him very pointedly at his public meeting that I'd studied economics all my life, and I was very, very scared as to what was going to happen to the economy. And I told him I thought that millions and millions of Americans were about to lose their homes because they couldn't pay their mortgages. And I don't like to say things like that to politicians without having at least a partial solution. So I reminded him of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation of the Franklin Roosevelt administration and how they've been put together to allow people to keep their homes. And Congressman Obey was very complimentary to me about what I said, but obviously he hasn't done a damn thing. And the problem here is that, let's say that the unemployment improves year and a half, 2 years from now, but with millions of Americans losing their homes through foreclosure, you're going to have people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s who are going to be starting out all over again like they're 18 years old.
Okay, let's get a response. James?
Yeah, absolutely. That caller has just hit a home run. The problem in the very beginning was a foreclosure crisis. And what has persisted now for 2.5 years is a failure to address directly and significantly that foreclosure crisis. In fact, I testified before Congress in January of last year asking for the creation of a homeowner loan type corporation that would model similarly, but with some important differences from the homeowner loan corporation of the 1930s, that the gentleman was referring to, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. The homeowner's loan was the one that actually focused on the homes themselves. But the reason I said that's a home run is that we still have a foreclosure crisis that's growing. And so it's hard to see an economic recovery in the face of a growing, the problem that brought down the financial system in the first place is still growing. And one of the things that's interesting is that you're seeing things like a jobless recovery. Well, everybody in the real world knows there is no such thing as a jobless recovery. And it's sort of one of those strange pieces of data that's coming out because it shows the extraordinary amount of subsidies to major financial institutions and other corporations that don't translate into helping working people. And it also mirrors what's happening in the banking industry. Extraordinary profits among the largest corporations, which, by the way, are en route to paying out billions, in fact, over $20 billion of bonuses, while lending is falling and the greatest number of bank failures in a single year is about to occur. It shows that the focus has not been on the problem, and that foreclosure crisis needs to be addressed in a much more substantial way. It's worth noting that just yesterday, the Treasury Department brought the servicers to Washington, D.C., to put more pressure on them to modify loans. But here's the story. They've been being brought to Washington since December of 2007, to modify loans, and that isn't working. We need to actually have the federal government take a much more aggressive position to actually take the decision out of the servicer's hands if they refuse to cooperate and help a borrower. And one of the ways to do that is with something called bankruptcy, to give a bankruptcy judge an opportunity to modify a loan to make it affordable. And that would then give the servicer the opportunity to do it for themselves or to have a bankruptcy judge do it. And guess how much that would cost the American public? Zero.
Hmm.
Nothing.
Yeah.
But it would address about 30% of the foreclosure crisis. Why we can't get members of the of Congress to do it, it's a mystery, or it's really a reflection of the continued strength of a banking industry, even in the middle of this crisis.
Right. I mean, it is amazing. These people don't seem to have any consciences, because you hear on the news, well, we had to give these people these huge bonuses because they would go elsewhere. What?
It's funny. When you wreck your company and you have to be taken over or you have to have a federal intervention to subsidize your way out of the crisis, the first thing that's normally done in a bank takeover is you fire the executives. You don't pay them a bonus to stay. So this has been a bank intervention that is historic and will be written about and read about for decades, if not centuries, to come.
Thanks so much for your call, Rick. Martin is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Kathleen. James Carr is absolutely right on the nose with everything he said. You know, the issue with jobs is related to the fact that the private sector in the United States didn't take an allegiance to the flag. They're making money in other parts of the world. They don't care about what's happening in the United States. The motor companies are making plenty of money overseas, but they don't care about work here because it's unprofitable to them. And, you know, we have to dig up, get our state and local and county and federal governments to realize that they have to watch out for our jobs and make them. They have to create them, as James Carr has been talking about, making public work programs again, you know, for parks and bridges and high-speed trains and all sorts of stuff, but the federal government or state governments have to underwrite this stuff because the private sector won't do it. They're too busy making money in other parts of the world.
James.
Yeah, I think that, again, Martin's comment is right on. A lot of multinationals not only are shipping a lot of their jobs out of the country, but they're now increasingly getting their profits from out of the country, which raises the question, what is the vested interest in the economic well-being of the American public? And so we need, but it's not just the private sector. I make that point. It's not just their behavior. It's their behavior that is empowered and encouraged by federal policies, including trade policies and tax policies, that allow them to behave in this manner. And the reason I say that is that you have to have a well-regulated market for the economy to work. And our markets are not well regulated. And so, for example, American workers are having to compete with workers in other countries that don't in any way respect worker rights. So they have no benefits. They, you know, they have no retirement plans, et cetera, et cetera. And that puts pressure on American workers to have to give up so much. And so that's one of the reasons why we have such poorly paying jobs today that have such poor packages of benefits. Many don't have health benefits. We certainly don't see guaranteed pensions as the norm anymore. Now you have to contribute to make your own, et cetera, and things are getting worse. So part of the blog that I wrote, the third part says rebuild the middle class, focuses on those broader long-term themes, which is we have to better regulate multinational corporations such that they have no choice but to focus on the economic well-being of the American public.
Do you have high hopes for the president's summit this Thursday, James?
Well, you know, the one quote that I read was where the again, I'm reading a newspaper article where the president says we've kind of done what we can do, and now we need to see what the private sector can do. I'm hoping that more comes out of the summit than that, because the fact of the matter is that the private sector is in no position to bring us out of this disastrous circumstance in which we find ourselves. It doesn't matter the roles that different institutions played, including the banking industry, in terms of getting us into the mess. What matters now is that a strong and a very focused federal intervention is needed. And one of the things this crisis did, it showed a lot of weaknesses in the structure of our economy that had been there for years that we didn't focus on. So, for example, one of the reasons that people have been piling on so much debt was because wage growth was either stagnant or falling. And so they were replacing, a failure of wages to increase with more debt and refinancing their homes more frequently, that sort of thing. And so a lot of those issues have just kind of now all come to the surface at one time. And this is a remarkable period for the president to really step back. The reason this website, by the way, is called New Deal 2.0 is that what they're saying is this is a time for broad and substantial thinking about the future of America. Yes, we have to deal with the most immediate job crisis, but we should be looking at longer-term issues such as the global competitive landscape, how it's changed since the last century to this century. I mean, look, we have a competitor now who, for the better part of the last century, wasn't even an issue, which is China. China has 1.3 billion people to compete against America, and we are 0.3. In order to be competitive, we need to make sure every single American who wants to work can work. Every American who wants a college education gets one. Everyone who wants to get a PhD in engineering, mathematics, and sciences, they should be able to get that degree. And that's only one component of developing a much more competitive landscape, a competitive infrastructure. But we need broader, bolder thinking by both the administration and Congress to get us out of this crisis and put us on a glide path toward a competitive future.
Well, I hope you're going to be at the summit, James. You sound like just that voice.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
All right. Thank you.
James Carr, Chief Operating Officer for the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He's done a great deal of work as Assistant Director for Tax Policy with the U.S. Senate Budget Committee, Research Associate at the Center for Urban Policy Research at Rutgers University. He served on congressional delegations to South Africa and Ghana on housing and economic development and has published extensively on housing and urban policy, housing finance, community reinvestment, personal financial services, and state and local finance. The perfect guy for this discussion today. We are continuing the discussion. Your phone call is still applicable to this half hour as we talk about how to get America back to work. The website that we have been referencing, you may want to go to yourself today. It's New Deal 2.0. It's a project of the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute, and they have been looking at what we can learn from that administration in terms of how we deal with unemployment here in the United States right now. We are welcoming more of your phone calls. Our guest now is Professor Alice O'Connor, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and director of the UCSB Washington Center Program in Washington, D.C. Our phone number remaining 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Professor O'Connor, thank you very much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
So what do we learn from the New Deal?
Well, we learn a tremendous amount. And frankly, I wish we would be willing to learn more, and I wish there would be more visible evidence that there was an openness to learning from the New Deal. I would say, though, from the get-go, that the major priority that the New Deal put on jobs, putting people back to work, and making work, making the job and what it paid and what it meant and the standards associated with it, really became the centerpiece of economic reform, one of the key centerpieces of economic reform in the New Deal. And right now, as we're facing really catastrophic levels of unemployment, as far as the eye can see, because none of the projections suggest that this is going to unemployment will be significantly reduced anytime soon, that to me would be the principal lesson of the New Deal, doing something about jobs and getting people back to work, but again, not just any old job. I mean, doing something about jobs and making jobs meaningful in terms of not only of what they paid, but what they did for people, how they anchored their lives. I think the New Deal reform project was based on an understanding of how important the job was and could be as a centerpiece of, well, what at the time was often referred to as life and labor.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned two books, and this was an interesting, and I think we're missing some of the public understanding of what it's like to not have a job right now and the hardships that families are facing. Instead, we hear about what the Dow is doing and, you know, whether Wall Street is recovering. Obviously, there's a huge sector of America that is not doing very well at all. You mention in your piece these two books, The Unemployed Worker and Citizens Without Work. And tell us about how those were done, the long process of people very carefully observing those who were unemployed.
Yeah, these are two. This is a piece that you're referring to that was, out on a couple of blogs, I think the Huffington Post, but also the Roosevelt Institute. And the Roosevelt Institute is an organization devoted to dealing with economic issues and a project that they refer to as New Deal 2.0. In any case, I wanted to bring to broader attention these absolutely classic studies that were done of unemployment during the 1930s. I think an important thing to realize is that these studies were begun in 1932 before E. White Backe, who is the principal author of the studies, and his team of researchers. This is based out of Yale University. Starting in 1932, before they could possibly know how long the Depression was going to last and how deep it was going to be, started a project to go out into the community, and in that case, the community was New Haven, to study, to observe directly the impact of unemployment and what, of course, eventually became very, very long-term and deep unemployment. The two books that were produced were published in 1940, and that gives you an idea of the long-term project. They were in the field from 1932 to 1939. The two books they produced were called The Unemployed Worker and Citizens Without Work. And to me, I love the title of the second book precisely because it captures so much of the meaning of what they found, which is that the prospect of citizens without work, of so many citizens without work, was a threat not only to well-being, not only to the psychological state of the individual worker, not only to families and the whole family system and the community system, but to the democracy. I mean, really, that is ultimately the great lesson of these studies, is that this long-term unemployment threatens people's ability to participate fully in what we should cherish most about our polity, which is the fact that it's a democracy.
Professor O'Connor, what do we need to do now to put Americans back to work?
Well, you know, there are lots of really good ideas out there. In fact, what I've been struck by and alternately cautiously optimistic about on the one hand and a little worried about on the other, I'm worried because I feel like, is anybody out there listening? I'm cautiously optimistic because you found a sort of a sudden spate of attention, especially in Congress, because a lot of Congress people are feeling concerned about, well, what's going to happen in the next election when I'm facing, you know, 10% plus job unemployment rates. A lot of good ideas have started to, you know, be bandied about. Number one, people once again are finally talking about direct job creation. That, again, was a centerpiece of the New Deal project, not just with the Public Works Administration that funded all sorts of infrastructure building, and that created jobs, but literally direct job creation through the Works Progress Administration. So I think that's, and all sorts of other programs. So I think that is one thing that needs seriously to get on the table, direct job creation, targeted to much-needed areas. You know, we can all name millions of opportunities for infrastructure building, for kind of economic restructuring kind of work that has to do with what people refer to as the green economy. But also jobs in the what we should think about as social infrastructure building. Our health care economy is growing on the one hand, but has huge gaps on the other. So we can think of many, many direct job creation projects that I think should be very high on the agenda. There are also a lot of ideas based on what's happening in some states as well as in Germany that have to do with various versions of job sharing, where if an employer keeps, you know, the workforce and people work, you know, less than full time, they can work through either the unemployment system or some other form of federal compensation to essentially enable people to work not full time, but at least be able to sustain a significant proportion of their salary without the employer necessarily taking a big hit. The idea is keep employment up. So that's another idea. There are also lots of ideas out there about various forms of targeted tax incentives that would, again, give some tax incentives for employers either to create new jobs, and that's a real big emphasis, of course, both sustaining and creating new jobs, or, again, even to target those jobs further towards certain populations, you know, youth jobs, youth apprenticeship kinds of jobs. So that's just, you know, some example of some of the ideas that are out there in terms of job creation. I guess the last thing I would mention on this list, which I think is really, really important, and anybody, you know, thinking about what's happening all around them on the local level should appreciate this, which is that we desperately need to get more aid revenue sharing to the states and localities, because right now we have so many states in fiscal crisis and looking out towards not only shrinking their public workforce but cutting back massively on public services and educational investments at the very moment when that is precisely the opposite of what we should be doing. So all of those things would help to sustain as well as to create new jobs, and we really need to get those things on the agenda.
Professor Alice O'Connor, our guest this half hour, professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara, director of the UCSB Washington Center Program in Washington, D.C. Our phone number, our lines are all busy, but you can get through eventually, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, we have a couple of those. Talk@WPR.org. Couple reminders for you. One is that we will be airing the Obama press conference dealing with Afghanistan, a major policy speech for him, and that is at West Point tonight. It will be aired at 7 o'clock. It will replace the second hour of On Point. So tonight at 7, you can hear that address. Second hour of our program today, we will speak with the author of On Thin Ice, The Changing World of the Polar Bear. Joseph Ellis, or Richard Ellis, will be joining us. He's the author of a number of books, is a celebrated marine artist whose paintings have been exhibited in museums all over the world. He's written about a number of other animals, tuna and whales and sharks. And somebody suggested that we call this second hour, which I think is appropriate, Polar Bears Against Climate Change. So that's coming up, hour number two. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now and emails. They're starting to pour in as well. Scott from Menominee, Michigan. Hi.
Good afternoon, or good morning. My concern is with the thought of another stimulus package, of giving them another bite at the apple. I mean, I think there should be some accountability with this. The last stimulative package was really not stimulative. I mean, once you get Congress involved in it, and if you really take the time, which I have, to read it, to look at it, anybody with even a bit of common sense can look at it and go, yeah, there's some good ideas in here for spending, be it money for the National Endowment for the Arts, be it an increase in food stamps. These are all good, worthy projects, but it had nothing to do with stimulating our economy and getting people back to work. And what bothers me more than anything else is that there doesn't seem to be the talk of accountability. I mean, once you have Nancy Pelosi in the House writing a bill like this and then the president signing it, which he should have really stepped up to the plate and said, no, this is not going to happen. I'm concerned about giving them another bite at the apple and spending another $1 trillion on something that just isn't going to work like the last one.
Professor O'Connor.
Yes. Well, in fact, there are, you know, many big debates about the stimulus package. On the one hand, there are people who said, well, the problem with the stimulus package was that it was not big enough. And not big enough to have the kind of impact in terms of job creation that it could have and should have had. So you have a lot of economists and others saying it should have been much bigger. Then you have others who, like the caller, are saying, well, it actually was inappropriately targeted on where we needed the stimulus most, especially in job creation. And part of that is because the Obama administration handed it over to Congress, and Congress put in a lot of pork and did things for their local district and didn't build in the accountability that should have been built in. So I would agree that if we're looking at a second stimulus, it absolutely needs to be targeted rather than sort of a lot of indirect measures that are, you know, supposedly putting money into people's hands to spend. Needs to be much more directly targeted on jobs creation and on getting some of those projects, especially those public works projects, started and going and actually making them accountable so that not only do they create new jobs, but they employ the people who are most in need of as well as qualified for that work.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple heartfelt emails here. I'm a teacher. After teaching for 17 years, I was downsized in June of this year. It seems that school districts aren't hiring teachers with years of experience and are going with college graduates so they don't have to pay as much money. I've applied for so many jobs since June and finally found a part-time minimum paying job in retail. I am not happy at this job, but it brings in a few dollars. I see my savings dwindling monthly, money I had earmarked for retirement. I have lost my health insurance. To be honest, I am frightened. I continue to apply for jobs in education, but considering my age, I'm afraid I will never be able to be in a classroom again. I love teaching, and I miss the interaction that I had with my students.
It is such a compelling statement of what is happening. And in fact, I just want to go back to the E. White Backe study. One of the reasons why that is such an important and again compelling study is precisely because it captures these themes about what does it actually mean to be in a position, as he put it, to make a living without a job. You know,
right.
Literally, how do you get by without a job? But the other thing that email tells us is that what's going on, and what actually has been going on for quite a long time now, I mean, you know, these high unemployment rates and the downsizing of work, if you will, is a part of a process that's been going on for quite a while, and you've really seen it in certain segments of the public sector, and unfortunately in education in particular. The way we've allowed our public educational infrastructure to erode precisely by such measures as kind of squeezing it to the minimum, not both hiring and paying, you know, the most qualified teachers and, you know, giving them career development opportunities and giving them the sense of security that they need to be a good teacher is absolutely tragic.
Yes.
And is completely undermining our future. It makes no sense whatsoever. So believe me, coming from the state of California, coming from the University of California,
yes,
and therefore part of a broad public educational infrastructure that is now being massively downsized from preschool through postgraduate education, I could not agree more with the person who wrote that email.
Irvin is our next caller from Linden. Hi, Irvin.
Hi, how are you this morning?
All right, Irvin, how are you?
I'm well.
Good.
You know, I've been listening the whole hour, and I'm an employer. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit that we've opened here in Madison. And what we do is educational. You know, I was listening to the email that you just read, and I feel really bad for that teacher. But, you know, what I'm faced with is we've grown so much in the last 2 years that we've been able to expand our learning centers from Madison. We just opened one in Oshkosh, and we're about to open another one in Milwaukee. But my problem is that I haven't been able to find any stimulus money for nonprofits. You know, I've checked into several different ways through the government. I'm not finding any money. But if I could have money to invest in these centers that we're opening throughout the state of Wisconsin, each center could employ 35 people easily. And because of the growth we have and the interest in what we do and how we do it, we've been growing by 800% per year, even during these economic downturn. So I'm looking for stimulus money for a nonprofit, and I'm just not sure if Dr. O'Connor or your previous person, James, can help me out with that.
Well, I can't tell you the particulars of, you know, what particular part of the stimulus, of the existing stimulus package, you know, could be used to leverage, leverage money for nonprofits, although I'm sure there are plenty of people who've studied it carefully to figure that part out. But what that speaks to is something I was referring to before in terms of a job creation package or something that could be done without direct job creation, which is a project to build, not just rebuild our physical infrastructure, of course, but to rebuild our social infrastructure. Now, this is precisely, I mean, talk about shovel ready, so to speak, which was, of course, the buzzword of the hour with the last stimulus package. Remember that?
Yes.
We want to fund shovel-ready projects. Well, I can't think of anything more shovel-ready, so to speak, than what you just told me about. A training program, an educational, a nonprofit organization that is ready to go and is ready to employ people, and with, again, an infrastructure builder building project that focused on the huge array of social needs, that is precisely the kind of thing that I think we should look to in the next stimulus package.
Right. He ought to find somebody who's on the guest list for Thursday's job summit at the White House and make sure that his story gets told to that person or those people, don't you think?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Do you have hopes for this job summit? Do you have hopes that somebody is going to seriously address this? Maybe they will because we have elections coming up again next year.
Well, I think that is the key. I mean, again, the key is not necessarily in the ideas. There are a lot of really good ideas out there, and I do think that that they'll be discussed at the Jobs Summit on Thursday. You know, they've got a lot of interesting sounding breakout sessions, and the rapidity with which you've seen again some good ideas bandied about in various websites and on various radio programs for that matter. Suggest to me it's not the lack of ideas or creativity. It is absolutely about the political will. Now, we're going to have a lot of people running for re-election in 2010, and their understanding is that, correct understanding as far as I can tell, we're going to be very deep in the Great Recession from the standpoint of jobs. When they're running for re-election. So they'll have a lot of pressure. On the other hand, you really need the centralized leadership from the White House. I mean, the White House has to send a very clear signal that its economic priorities is going to be a jobs-centered recovery. It's got to come out, they've got to come out and say, you know, despite all this talk of the recession being over, we look around us, we look at all these communities, we look at the youth unemployment rate, which is, 25%
yes.
plus, and that is not a recovery. So we are going to have a job-centered recovery as our number one economic priority.
Thank you so much for being with us. You're just terrific. I hope you'll join us again. Thank you. Professor Alice O'Connor, Professor of History at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this great hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production as well. We have news coming up, and we'll return here on the Ideas Network.